This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor with Professor H.J. Mackinder, International Relations. We go to Brussels, which is simultaneously the capital of NATO and the European Union. The ambition by the European Union counselors is to impose a price cap on Russian oil so that come December 5th, no European Union state will be buying Russian oil. It's chiefly by sea. That's how the Russians sell the oil. However, they also will impose a cap on what someone can pay, maximum they can pay for Russian oil. And the way they will do this is to tell the insurance companies they will be sanctioned if they provide insurance to any tank, any carrier of Russian oil. That means that no carrier can move without that insurance. It effectively ends the ability to transfer Russian oil unless you pay the price. Now, the price came in at 62, 63, 64, 65, somewhere in that region. But Greece objects because it wants it higher. Greece earns money on shipping. Poland objects because it wants it lower. It wants to punish Russia and anybody who buys from Russia. And all the rest of the European Union are wandering around in between. There is disunity. And the reason I go on at length about this is not to comment on the price of a barrel of oil once the cap is imposed, but that the European Union is no longer united to defeat Russia. Your comment, Professor.
Well, I agree with you that what this chiefly demonstrates is a lack of basic agreement about policy objectives within NATO. I have no idea about the price of oil, but when you think of all kinds of seemingly small issues and the impossibility of Europeans ever agreeing on anything, I suppose I'm not surprised. The question is, how is this discussion going to affect the war? I think that the countries that are, remember, of course, the Ukrainians have no heat. That's for starters, and winter is coming. But who are the most problematical states within NATO, major states? Well, really, France and Germany are the ones who are most concerned. Germany has a complex internal political situation, which makes it very difficult for her to make decisions. And Mr. Scholz is highly inconsistent with even with respect to his own policy over time. France thinks of herself as being the great European power. I don't think anybody else does. But here's the thing. Neither France nor Germany is involved enough in the actual fighting in Ukraine really to make a difference. In other words, if they both stopped supplying, if they basically got out of the war effort, the war would continue because we, the United States, and to some extent the British, and then, of course, neighbors such as Czech Republic, Slovakia, Poland, etc., and the Baltic states, they are the ones who are actually making it possible for the war to be fought. So you can say that with respect to the war, what Germany and France decide is of little importance, except perhaps to France's conception of herself as a great power. But remember that both of those countries, Germany and France, will be threatened directly by Russia if Russia is not defeated. So what they seem to want is for the Ukrainians to defeat the Russians pretty soundly, but mostly with American help. And then once that rather difficult phase is done, they want us and the Ukrainians to step aside so that they can engage in discussions with Moscow. Mrs. Merkel surfaced today saying how much she regretted not having talked to the Russians about Ukraine and not having talked to the Ukrainians in her very long period in charge of Germany. It is odd that she didn't ever bring those things up, but, you know, she can't go back. What I would remind our listeners of is that even that constructing a stable relationship with Russia is proved impossible, even when Gorbachev, who was by far the most outstanding Russian interlocutor we've had, and he was a man of real vision who really wanted to solve the whole Cold War problem, but he didn't have the key, and he was unable to keep support at home. And Mr. Yeltsin, who was a rougher man than Gorbachev, but he did certain necessary things, such as making the Communist Party illegal, freeing prices, and all the rest. But even then, when we had in Moscow people who with whom we should have shared a great deal of sympathy, we were unable to end the Cold War. And if you read about these people and you read their memoirs and so forth, it's almost painful to see how close we came. So the question is, what's going to happen now with Europe? Well, one possibility is that NATO is going to end up divided into a militarily competent wing and then one that isn't. I think we're going to see the spread of minimal nuclear deterrence. I think Sweden, Germany, and Poland are likely candidates for nuclear power. But I think the most important thing to understand is that this war is the gate through which the United States is passing and Eurasia is passing from a world in which Western Europe and European security, as defined within NATO, was the key, and the rest of the world, say Japan, South Korea, India, China, and so forth, were not really considered as having the same centrality. What we have to remember is that the peace that's going to emerge from this, if we ever get one, is going to have to be Eurasian in scope. Remember that the Japanese can sink the French Navy. The new Indian aircraft carrier is, in many ways, better than the French Charles de Gaulle. I mean, the French are trying to steal nuclear propulsion technology from us. We should ask the question, how is South Korea to deal with a thermonuclear armed North Korea? Well, the way France and England have dealt with the Soviet or the Russian threat is to have their own nuclear weapons over which we have no control. And I would argue that in the post-Ukraine world, we're going to see countries like South Korea and Japan having their own nuclear forces, minimal, I should say, but adequate for the job, and without what's called the permissive action link. In other words, they would belong to the Koreans or to the Japanese, and they would be able to fire them whenever they wanted to. They wouldn't have to have someone turn a key in Washington to make the weapons operative. That's the way the English and the French weapons are now. They don't have to get permission from the United States to launch from their deterrent force. So what is most needed in Europe and also in Washington, which we'll get to in a second, we need the imagination to see that any lasting war termination in Ukraine that's going to bring peace to the world is going to require a fundamental restructuring and redistribution of burdens of Eurasian security. It can't simply be a slightly modified version of the way things were when this war began. And I believe that probably the three countries that are going to be key will be Japan, India, and Britain. I would say Germany. Germany is naturally the most powerful country in Europe, but I just don't think that they can deal politically effectively enough with themselves to be able to take on a leadership role. So we have distraction. I think you've noticed that there's Peking, Beijing exercises a strange magnetic attraction, not least to our own administration, but the Prime Minister, the German Chancellor, has already been there. Now it turns out that Charles Michel, who is a Frenchman but President of the European Council, is going to Beijing on December 1st. And I have no idea what he thinks he's going to find there or what he's going to talk about. But there seems to be a belief that somehow Beijing is part of the solution. But I don't think that that's correct. But this illusion is very deeply seated in the United States and in Europe.
All right, we're headed to China. Professor H.J. Mackinder, International Relations, we're on our way to Beijing. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.